Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Breakthrough Directions. Each week, Breakthrough Directions explores the two faces of your business, outward through marketing and client delivery, and inward your vision, profit model, systems, team, and you, so you can grow a business you love and live the life of your dreams. Welcome to the show.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Linda Feinholz, your host for Breakthrough Directions on Blog Talk Radio, coming to you as I do each week, live at noon Eastern, 9 Pacific. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, and Gina Gaudio-Graves will be joining us from Florida. We're each experiencing the wonderful joys of technology challenges. This morning I got on the phone line I normally use to join our show and found it had been turned into a party line, so I spent a little bit of time scrambling to find another clear phone line to call in on, and Gina will be joining us from her end as well. So I am absolutely thrilled with the guests that I'm able to bring to all of us, to us and to all of our listeners today. Brad Leggett and I have known each other actually for nearly 20 years, and I'm thrilled to be able to share him and his background and his experience with our audience, because I have treasured not only his friendship but his wisdom when it comes to the challenges of creating really effective sales systems and sales organizations. And his entire career has been based on his own expertise and taking that expertise into his client organizations. Brad works with the CEOs and vice presidents of sales organizations to build, lead, and retain high-performance sales teams. And we're going to talk about what that means. He's worked with over 100 companies in 19 different industries, and he's not only worked locally or regionally, he's worked globally. And I find all of that is so relevant in today's market, when everything we're doing with our services and our products really is in consideration of not only what our local potential customers might want, but also how to expand that to regional and even global sales. So Brad has helped his clients obtain results of up to 300% sales growth for clients. And there's so much experience that I'm so delighted, Brad, to have you joining us here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you.
So as a little bit of, I guess, definition for folks, we have people from so many different industries who join us and listen to the guests that we bring to the show. And Gina and I spend a tremendous amount of time helping people understand the core importance of relationship building in business building. And often we're talking about that from the perspective of marketing through relationship building. And I would love if we could spend a little bit of time helping people make the distinction between marketing and sales. How do you address that, your clients?
You're talking about the distinction between what's marketing and what's sales and the questions wrapped around that?
Exactly.
To me, marketing is all the activities that you engage in to get to the state where you've got a lead, somebody interested in your product or service. Once you've got that interest established, sometimes called a lead, then it becomes a sales activity where you're pursuing a specific opportunity with them. So advertising is certainly marketing. Websites, social media, all those activities I would place in the marketing bucket. Somebody calling directly on a customer or following up on an email inquiry, to me that's selling. So that's really the point of distinction I make. All the things we do to get the word out there about our company, generate a level of interest in it, name recognition, understanding about the products and services we have. That's all in the marketing bucket. Once we've got that interest and somebody wants to know about a specific product or service with us, or we're making a call on them, to me that's sales.
Many years ago, there was a metaphor I remember somebody sharing with me that was along the lines of marketing is leading the horse to the water trough, and sales is getting him to actually dip his head in and drink.
I haven't heard that before. I really like it. Another metaphor I look at, marketing is about the forest, sales is about a tree.
Oh, that's cool. I like that one.
Marketing is growing that forest, that name recognition, getting the word out there. We're interested in growing a forest with certain types of trees in it. Now that they're mature, it's time to harvest one, that's sales.
Oh, I really like that distinction. It's a great imagery. And we're going to climb into a lot of aspects around how to create really effective sales performance, no matter the kind of industry people are in, no matter the kind of company. I think it would be great if we could talk a little bit about this online world. I was, we have publications that are now shutting. Time is still going. Newsweek has closed its offline magazine and is taking it all online. And we have bookstores closing because Amazon can deliver better and so on. There seems to be this zone of a blur between what people actually think of as selling versus, oh, it's just this convenience of I just go online to place my order. And I think people are starting to lose the distinction that they're actually being sold to in order to get that order placed.
So you're talking about somebody who goes online to place an order and the other activities that go with it?
Yeah. So, especially in this world where so much of marketing is done online, it seems to be this really smooth transition into educating a client and then taking them straight into the cart to place their order.
Let's peel the onion and put a couple layers back on it before they even get to placing the order. Because if we look at auto sales these days and what's going on there, and quite often the buyer walks into the showroom now highly educated on the automobile, possibly better than the salesman. They already know what they want. They're just in there to get a price. And they may have even established the price point before they walk in the door by some online bidding. So customers tend to be very well educated today. 20, 30 years ago, if we're talking about capital goods sales or larger item sales, a key component of the salesperson's job was about educating the customer about the product and where it fit and how it could be best used. In today's world, most of the time the customer is already well educated on that if they're thinking about a significant purchase. So they're already been on the web, researched it, understood your product, where it fits, looked at the competition. They know all that. They're looking much more for specifics about use for them and their specific application. That usually can't be represented that well in a website. So they're looking for very specific education about the product or service when they engage with a salesperson. Sometimes this is done entirely online, and we see a lot of selling activities. If we go to an online website and we place an order for a product, it's very common that businesses are saying, people who have ordered this also ordered things like. That's selling right there because it's making suggestions about what else to buy. So it's really changed the paradigm of selling from where it was 20, 25 years ago.
And it's created a new challenge for the level of education in a sales force themselves, like the sheer depth and breadth of what they must know and understand in order to be the problem solver for that prospective customer or client.
You're exactly right, Linda. And the depth of knowledge, and again, I'll come back to how your product or service plays in a specific situation. One of the biggest challenges I see with sales teams that I get to work with, and it's borne out by a study done by Chief Marketing Officer Magazine. And in that study, chief marketing officers surveyed around the nation, 70% of them said their sales teams could not effectively position and sell their company's products or services against the competition. The sales team only knew them at a somewhat superficial level. And if we want a sales team to be highly effective, and this really plays into the service market, they need to understand how your service works for particular clients in particular situations. To answer that need, I've actually developed a process called story-based selling. And it comes from the philosophy that people buy on one or two things. They're either buying on facts, the statistics about what it can do, how many widgets it can turn out an hour, how fast it runs. Or they're looking for examples of when somebody's used that service or that product in a situation similar to theirs. And it also plays to what I call situational need. The old philosophy was you had a unique value or unique selling proposition for your company. How is your company different from all the other companies in the market? One, there's a real question, is it? Secondly, I work with more entrepreneurial companies, middle market companies, those under $100 million in revenue. We generally don't have in-depth knowledge of our competitors and how they perform, things that would take extensive market studies to find out. So I say if you're going to try and create a unique value proposition that's meaningful and you don't have the basis for it, you've got a real challenge trying to do it. Secondly, a unique value proposition in today's market, you're trying to put it against an amalgam or average of all your clients. And because clients are so well educated, they want to know how that product or service works for them, not for others. So that's where I came up with story-based selling and developed this process. And it starts with identifying the key pain points clients have. And most sales teams and management teams know this well. We define those pain points and then come up with a question to ask to find out if that pain exists. Then we put the facts together about how the company can fulfill that need. And then we mine the tribal knowledge that exists. And this is a really powerful part because almost all companies have this great tribal knowledge of where your product or service works and how it works best and stories of how that happened. The challenge is it's a senior sales guy or the CEO or one or two others that have 80% of the tribal knowledge, and the balance of the sales team doesn't have it. If we capture those stories, put them in a way that's easy to tell or relay, and then train the sales team to be able to use those stories, it's an extremely powerful selling tool. You know, if you get three salespeople to walk in an account, and let's say you're doing painting services, because it's an example I'm going to use in a moment, and all three of them might walk into a prospective customer, in this case, property management companies. And they might walk into a property manager and say, I'm with ABC Painting Company. We've been in business for 18 years. We're locally owned. We only work with the HOA community, and we've done 60 projects. The next two people walk in, hear exactly the same thing. How does a buyer make a decision? One of two ways. Most likely on price. Possibly they might make it on who they buy best. If we contrast that with being able to go in and ask specific pain point questions, identify the needs of the buyer, and then relay how our company really can fulfill that, it transforms that sales conversation. An example might be something like for this painting company, one of the ones we came up with was the ability to finish a job on time. I don't know how many in the audience have had a construction project in the last 3 to 5 years. I often ask this when I'm speaking, and I ask for people to raise hands, and 10 will go up, and I'll ask, everybody who's had that job finish on time, keep your hand up, and maybe one or two hands will stay up. So finishing jobs on time in the construction world is a major issue. We knew it was a pain point. So we trained the team to ask, you know, tell me about jobs you've had that haven't finished on time lately, because that's a common problem. If you get a yes to it, then they could respond with what they've learned about the company that had over 100 people on staff, trained and well-supervised, to come off and take care of the job. Then one of the stories we mined was about a homeowners association with 253 units literally hanging off the side of a cliff. The board had expected, the buyers expected the project to take 8 months. The company finished it in 4 to the delight of the homeowners association. So we gave them a pain point to work with, questions to ask, trained them on the facts about the company, and gave them this and other stories they could relay to really bring that home. And it really made a major difference in the sales conversations.
That is so valuable, so powerful. And the question that came to mind as you were discussing how to work with an entire sales team to mine for the experience and the wisdom and the stories that then can be used through the entire sales team is it speaks to the need to create a sales team that operates as a team and isn't based on competing with each other per se. Because if you have everybody competing with each other, then they're not going to share the stories. They're not going to share that wisdom.
You do want a team atmosphere, and you want what I would consider healthy competition. You want people with sales targets that are clear and well-established, and you want them driven to get them. But you want them competing against that target, not against the other person on the team, so they're willing to help out. And you're going to the core of, if you want a highly effective sales team like that, that really comes down to the company culture you have. And do you have a company culture that values sharing? And does the CEO exemplify that and have the executive team show how they share and work with each other? Because if you have a highly competitive, somewhat cutthroat culture, we can ask and tell the sales team to share, but they'll see the company culture. If they see the walk goes with the talk about sharing and helping, then they're on board with that. And when somebody like a senior salesperson helps out a junior salesperson, they should be recognized loudly for that, both directly to them and in front of the team, and talk about how this person is mentoring and helping the other person. So they're thanked for it, and it reinforces that behavior. So they'll be willing to share the stories and help the other people.
So when an organization has reached a size where people really do start specializing in what they're spending their time on, so that the CEO might be spending time with key customers, but he or she has a distinct sales team, how do you go about ensuring that you've got the right people on the sales team?
Well, 2 points here. One, as you said, the CEO might be spending time with key customers. I would pose the CEO is spending time with key customers. That if the CEO really wants to stay in touch with their market, particularly as their team grows and it gets a larger organization, she or he needs to be making regular visits to key customers and occasionally some calls on some smaller customers to really stay in touch with the market and hear what's going on out there. On the second point you're touching on, and it's the number one issue I see when we have an underperforming sales team, and that is, do we have the right people on the bus or right people on the team? And you were earlier talking about a metaphor analogy, and the one I use, my wife's an interior designer, and you walk into a paint store and say, I want yellow. They don't turn to the shelf and pull off a can of yellow. They pull out a paint deck or a set of chips, and they'll say, of these 42 shades of yellow, which one are you looking for? And just like there are 42 shades of yellow in that paint deck, there are probably at least that many different types of sales jobs out there. Is it a direct sales job, meaning directly calling the customer? Is it a channel sales job, meaning somebody calls on distributors or VARs or manufacturers reps who actually call on the customer? Is it an inside sales job? If so, are they taking calls or making calls? Those are all differences. Is it a capital sales job, meaning, you know, you're selling something for $100,000, or is it just transactions where you're selling maybe fuel or supplies that just keep being bought on a repetitive basis? And different people fit these different jobs. So simply because someone's been successful in one sales job doesn't transform them to be successful in another type of sales job. The technique I was taught to get some real granularity or clarity around this is called performance profiles. And in a performance profile, we focus on the 3 to 5 key deliverables in the job. And contrast that with a job description. A job description might well have 12, 14, 16 line items in it, not necessarily in priority order. And they're all things we're asking the person to do in this job. Don't know about you, but if you give me 16 different things to do, I'm not going to get them all done. And if I don't have a clear sense of expectations and priorities, I'm not going to necessarily focus on the right one. So in a performance profile, we focus on the 3 to 5 key deliverables in a job. And once we've got it locked down, we begin to set results and activity levels behind it so we're very clear. An example of one, worked with a company, software company, smaller, about $2 million a year in sales. Historically, the CEO had been the person out selling for the company. She'd made a decision to step back out of the active CEO role, turn it over to one of the other managers to run the company, and really take a just a board-level position with the company and not be active in its management or the sales effort. So we needed someone to pick up that proactive sales effort and bring in new clients. They're selling software to school districts. It sells for about $100,000 per instance or installation. So, and it was a smaller company. There was no lead generation effort going on, or at least a minimal one for some trade shows. So some of the things we look for in this person based on that company and the situation they're in, number one, we needed someone who could go off and develop their own leads, generate them, either through phone conversations, emails, or in-person visits, and we weren't particular, but we wanted, number one of our 5 key deliverables in the job, the ability to generate leads, because if you didn't do that, the rest wasn't going to matter. Number two was make sales target. And if that's not number one or number two in a performance profile for a salesperson, I'm going to challenge the performance profile you're putting together. So we wanted somebody with a track record of achieving sales with large capital sales. Third, because we're dealing with something at the $100,000 level going to a school district, there were 3 to 4 executives in that school district, like the chief business officer, chief financial person, head of facilities, that are all going to be very involved in the decision-making process before it's ever presented to the board. So we needed someone who could work a large account and develop relationships with multiple decision-makers and influencers. Fourth, because it was a technical sale, we didn't expect the salesperson to be able to do the demos and answer the technical questions on his or her own. It was going to be a team sale with an account manager who could do the demo and some of the support work. And fifth, we're selling into the K-12 world, and that's a very tight community. And so there was a marketing aspect of this, and not in the sense of websites or literature, but affiliation marketing. Somebody who had a track record and was willing to go attend association meetings, state board meetings, for two reasons. One, to really learn how that world operates so he or she could talk about it in a broader way than just the specific sale that you're trying to make and understand the issues these people are facing that you're selling to. And secondly, it's a great way to begin to build relationships with other people in the industry and be able to get your foot in the door rather than just having a cold call in there. So the key five deliverables in this job, number one, the ability to cold call in some manner and develop leads. Secondly, making sales target, a track record of doing that with large capital sales. Third, the ability to get in and build and work relationships at key accounts. Fourth, the ability and a track record of working with others to do a team sale. And finally, that affiliation marketing. So those were our five key deliverables in a job. When you're putting those together, the other thing I'd suggest is get them listed out and then take a look and say, what do I expect the person to do in the first 90 days in each of these? That's really the acid test. When you've got clarity there and it all makes sense, then you've got a good performance profile to hire against. And that becomes the basis for who you're going to hire, developing your interview questions, setting up performance profiles and performance reviews and performance expectations on a go-forward basis. So if we have real clarity about the person we're looking for that fits this job, we've got a real chance of success when we hire that person and bring them on board.
You know, one of the things that was very striking to me as you were describing all of that is it's so in line with the messages that I give to the business owners and entrepreneurs that I work with. Very often when I ask them how they staff certain positions, it was they took the fastest route possible, someone who knew someone, and it was okay if they were not too experienced because they'd trained them on the job. Excuse me. But it becomes clearer and clearer that the highest way to create the fastest way to create a high-performing team is rather to go for the experience. And when you create that performance profile, now you can really item by item say, does this candidate actually have that experience? Are they bringing it in to help lift the company to the next level rather than turning us into a training organization?
You're exactly right there, Linda. You and I see similar things. And you're talking about I'll hire the person I know through synagogue or church or wherever, or I got referred to them through some association I know, and they sound like a good person, so I trust them, I'll hire them. And trust is certainly a key aspect of the job, but beyond that, you're talking about the relevant experience they bring to the table to take the company to the next level. You know, a client you and I both worked with, early-stage software company, and I'd worked with him for several months helping him define exactly which set of products to bring into the market, this whole backstory there. But define what to bring into the market. He thanked me for the work, and we didn't engage again for about a year. But as I was wrapping up the assignment initially, I counseled him. I said, if you want to grow this company, it's about $1 million a year in sales, and get it much past this, you're going to have to bring in a professional sales manager to help you. And he went off and brought somebody in, and they were selling software to medical labs. And the person he brought in was there for about 6 months as a sales manager and not having any success. And he looked at it and said, would you come up and help me with this? So I came up, met with the CEO, met with the VP of sales for about half an hour, said, okay, I've learned what I need to know, and went in with the CEO and said, look, I've got some unfortunate news for you. You need to terminate this person, and we need to find somebody else for the job. And he says, wait a second, why? I said, well, you wanted somebody that could sell software. He certainly can do that. Great track record success there. You want somebody with experience selling into the healthcare industry, better yet, to medical labs. Well, he actually has experience with medical labs. That's wonderful. However, you're selling software that's about $250,000 per transaction. This guy's experience set is selling what's called shrink wrap software. That's the type of product that sells for between $50 and maybe $250 per transaction. So he's a transaction salesperson, doesn't have the background in navigating highly complex deals through multiple layers and working that type of sale. And I said, you're a young company. You don't have the time to transform him, even if we could, and most likely that's not the type of salesperson he is. And so he took my advice. We cut the guy loose so he could go find another job where he could be successful, and I believe he was. And then we went off and did a search for a new sales manager that we hired that had the background in large-scale transactions to the medical and healthcare industry, didn't have direct medical lab experience, but had the other key components of the job. and he drove sales while he was there to about $8 million. So having the right person on board and really understanding all the attributes of the job is essential.
Would you consider that an example of perhaps the biggest challenge or weakness that you see needs to be corrected in most of the sales teams that you work with?
Absolutely. That is number one. The big three, number one is having the right people on the sales team. The second one is about clarity of sales goals, performance management. And the third we've already talked about is training your sales team and working with them on more than just a training session, but coaching and helping them understand how to position your product or service in the market, particularly versus competition, and helping them understand the stories and examples of when it fit. If you have those three things in place, you're most likely going to have a successful sales team. In fact, I'll say this. If there's one thing you focus on, it's that performance profile, understanding the job, and bringing the right people on board. Because if I've got the right people on board, I'm probably going to have success right there. If I want to accelerate that success, I want to look at performance management, sales targets and goals, and then training the team on how to most effectively sell the company's product or service. When I'm talking about performance management, I'm talking about clarity and sales goals. And often when I walk in, particularly with entrepreneurial companies, I don't see sales goals in place. And the response goes something like either, well, we don't know how to set them, so we haven't, or we set them a couple of times and nobody made them, and it just made everybody mad, so we gave up. And I pose to you, high-performance salespeople want goals. In fact, I was in a client yesterday, and one of the issues for the new salesperson, she says, I don't have clarity about my goals and what's expected of me, so I'm not sure where to spend my time. So salespeople do want clarity about where they're headed and what they're supposed to do. And when I talk about goal setting, I'm talking both at the revenue level and the underlying sales activity level. We want to give them goals to hit for what you need to do in the way of revenue or gross profit generated on a monthly basis, or if it's a longer-term sales, potentially in a quarterly. But underlying that, particularly for longer-term sales, let's look at number of sales calls that need to be made, number of opportunities identified, number of proposals out the door, all early indicators of whether somebody's having success in the job or not. And when we do that and set it in a collaborative way with the sales team, we've got a very powerful tool. It becomes one they're responsible for and own rather than one just handed to them. So sales goals need to be demanding. They should be. Push the team. And they need to be achievable, because if they're not seen as achievable, then they're a demotivator rather than a motivator. But if we've got them well set and have them have a say in setting them, it's a really powerful management tool and takes a lot of burden off of management, frankly.
I suspect you and Gina could have hours and hours of conversation about selling, because
I
know.
And I just unmuted to do that, Linda.
Exactly. It's like I think the two of you could have fabulous dinners with war stories, you know, from your background in selling as well.
I'll bet we could. Hello, Gina.
Hello, Brad. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you as well.
I want to give context for our listeners. So many of our listeners are solopreneurs who really should have sales teams in place. Most of our listeners will have high-end, back-end products or services. Sometimes it's a coaching or mentoring program. Sometimes it's a done-for-you service. And right now, many of our listeners are making all of those sales calls themselves. And they really shouldn't be. That's continuing to work in their business and not on their business.
Mm-hmm.
So from what you've shared already, how much of what you've shared applies in the solopreneur's business when they really should be putting together a sales team?
What are you talking about? What they should be doing if they're going to stay solo, or what they should be doing if they're considering putting together a sales team, Gina?
They should do both. Even if they're a solopreneur, they should have a sales team.
Okay. Well, let
and
me
it's
speak
one
as
of
a
their
solopreneur.
Biggest actually.
Let me speak as a solopreneur who is responsible for the sales for his own consulting practice, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've done for myself, I talked about setting sales goals and activity goals.
Mm-hmm.
Is 3 years ago, I got very clear with myself, and I said, you know, you help set this up for others, and it's time to get rid of the cobbler's children syndrome, where you do it for others and not for yourself. And I sat down and established very specific activity goals on a monthly basis for myself. And in doing that, that made sure I would carve out time from client work and other things to engage in activities that drive business, like establishing new referral relationships, speaking opportunities, blogs, the other things that get my name out there and establish people's interest. And then I began to track that and establish an accountability partner that I report back to. In doing that, the lead volume for my services is about tripled. And it takes discipline. It takes time. It's demanding. I appreciate all those things that people can raise their hand and say, yeah, but. However, if you want to grow your business, it's necessary. So if you're going to be in the sales role, you really need to establish what activities bring in business for me, set goals for them and track them and talk about how you're doing. And better yet, if you belong to a Vistage or other similar type group, get an accountability partner in there to help you stay on track with this. And talk about the roadblocks and frustrations you're having so they can help you through them. So that's
great
one
advice.
Of the key things I would really counsel for somebody who's going to stay in the sales role rather than handing it off. If we're back to establishing a sales team, and I've worked with 3 clients in the past few months to establish their initial sales team, or sales, in the case it's usually one salesperson they're bringing in,
mm-hmm.
Number one thing we do is back to establishing their performance profile. What's this job about? Then we begin to establish the sales activity levels and expectations and lay that out in detail for the first 90 days and at a higher level for the first year. So the CEO gets a real sense and a solid place to look about how's this person going to perform against these goals so I can measure them and know what they are. Third, of course, gets into compensation plans, and I can talk about those in a second, but establish a compensation plan that's rewarding to the salesperson. Those are the first 3 things I look to do if we're establishing a sales team for the first time. You know, who do we need on board? What are the expectations we're going to have? Then the compensation. Once we're ready to hire, we're getting close to that, then set up that onboarding process to how do we bring them in the company and train them to sell the company's products and services.
Let's talk a little bit about the compensation plan.
Okay.
When you are bringing a team in, so many entrepreneurs that I work with look at it as it's going to cost them money. They don't really realize that it is truly a profit center. It's not costing them anything. Can we talk about how the compensation works so that it can be a profit center and not an expense?
Well, I'm right with you, Gina. One of the things I do when I set up compensation plans is I talk about here's the expense part of it, both base salary if there is one, commissions is a part of it, what's your uplift, you know, things like insurance and FICA and the other things like that, and expenses, and talk about what's the total burden cost of this person. Let's get clear about that. Then let's talk about sales expectations over the first 90 days, first year, and potentially out to year 2, and then look at a return on investment for each one of these. So we've got a clear understanding of what this person should be bringing in and contribution to margin and potentially net profit of the company. And we understand, you know, what our investment period will be when we'll run net negative to when we begin to run net positive on the person. So there's a lot of clarity around what I'm expecting to pay and then what I should be getting in return for that. So it's not just a conversation about cost, it's a conversation about investment and a return on my investment. We get to setting up compensation plans, and I've done about 250 of them, as well as been a sales comp manager in corporate America. I really look at it as like you're building a stool and there need to be 4 legs to it. And the first of those 4 legs is there needs to be clarity around the company's goals. What are you looking for your sales team to achieve? And that, what direction do you want them to go? And I would say the number one complaint I have when I'm first looking at redoing a sales comp plan is managers will be saying, well, these salespeople are just chasing these dollars over here and they're not doing what I want them to do. My response to that is sales compensation is a management tool. We need to be clear about what we want them to do and line the money up behind it because people will follow the money. That's a message.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Secondly, we need to have sales goals. And we talked about establishing demanding but achievable goals. Sales goals that are in line with what can be achieved because the sales team sees they can achieve the goal and the money behind it. They're motivated. if they see the goals as unachievable, no matter how rich the compensation plan looks, they're not going to buy into it. Third, and I can say this as a little sales guy, I can calculate a commission check to 16 digits in my head right now. You ask me to keep up with more than three major goals and achieve all of them, I'll start to lose it. What I'm driving at is simplicity in the plan. Early on, I used to develop some fairly complex plans because we had complex situations. And I began to realize that wasn't the way to really get a salesperson's attention or keep it. And through time, I've learned to really drill down and keep those plans very clear and very simple so salespeople can follow them, wake up every morning and know what they're supposed to do to make the money, achieve the plan, and make the goals the company wants. And finally, a lot of companies don't have necessarily a robust accounting and commission system. So let's make sure whatever commission system we set up, we can pay on accurately and on time. Because if we don't, again, we have a major demotivator. So no matter how much we might want to go to, say, a gross margin-based system, which I like, if our systems don't support it, we'll probably need to stay on a revenue-based system so we can make sure we pay accurately and on time. If those four components are in place, you've got an effective comp plan that'll work and can be around for a good period of time. If one of them's missing, you've got a real issue.
Great advice. Linda, I'll let you jump in.
You know, one of the things that's fascinated me over time is that decision point, that sort of line in the sand of bringing on or expanding a sales team. And I find, Brad, that so often it's that the leader of the company, the manager of that sales team, does not know how to manage salespeople. And there's some real keys that are that I think it's worth our talking about today, because when we talk about whether you're a solopreneur and you're deciding to let others do the selling so you can manage customer relationships and potentially be the one in charge of delivery of those products or services and so on, I'd love us to spend some time talking about how one evolves into an effective manager of salespeople.
Well, let's talk about the role of the sales team leader, because I think that really plays into there. And I have a presentation I give to CEO groups about building high-performance sales teams. And when we get to the role of the sales team leader, I bring up a picture. And it rapidly tells where I went to school, because it's a picture of our college football coach for my LSU Tigers. And I say the reason I bring this up is not to help you understand where I went to school, though I'm glad to share that. It's to talk about the role of the sales team leader is analogous to a college coach. And it's about achieving results through others, not achieving results through yourself. So someone's promoted out of sales into sales management. It's a major mind shift for them, because up till now you've been responsible for bringing in revenue. Now you're responsible for building and leading a team, which brings in the revenue. And like a coach in a college sport, the first thing you've got to do to have an effective team is, one, determine who belongs on it, that performance profile. Once I've decided who I need on the team, whether it's a new quarterback this year or a new linebacker or whatever, or combination thereof, and I know what I want on them, I've got to go off and recruit that talent. So the second thing is, and talent is about recruiting that talent, and it needs to be something that's on an ongoing basis. Like a coach, I need to be coaching and directing them at a couple levels. One, establishing goals with them. Is this guy going to be a starter? Somebody going to sit on the bench, or do we cut them from the team? What are the expectations they have to be a starter and a star? And translate those for them, and clearly. And then lead them through practice sessions and coaching and calls with them in the field where you're helping them get better at their skill set. And finally, you're the person that's the glue or the interface between the sales team and the company. You know, sales is about the only job I know of where a 90% failure rate is considered a success. You know, for every yes I get 8, 9, 10 no's in one form or the other, an explicit no, a door closed, a call not responded to, etc. And so it's a job with a lot of demands in it, but I've got some legitimate needs as a salesperson I need the company to back me up on, whether it's a pricing situation, coming out to make a call by the CEO on this customer, whatever that is. And when it's legitimate, I need the sales manager to have my back and go get that resource for me or help me understand how to deal with the situation. And conversely, the company needs to set its goals and objectives and its vision. And it's the job of the sales manager, like a coach, to translate that vision to the sales team so they understand where you're headed and why. So we were talking about, you know, what makes for an effective sales team leader. It's getting your mindset around being a coach rather than being a contributor and achieving results through others, and that your job is to build a team, and through a team you're going to achieve revenue. And so when people can get their heads into that, they become highly effective sales team leaders.
And not only that, they become highly effective as the CEO of their business, whether they're a solopreneur or they've got a team of 5 or 50 and so on.
Exactly.
One of the things that I dealt with last year with one of my clients was a real tug of war that she was having mentally between whether she should promote from within into the newly created manager of sales role rather than bringing someone in from outside. And I suspect you've got some thoughts about all of that.
I certainly do. And you were talking about whether they bring them in from outside or promote within. My preference, all things being equal or close to equal, would be promote within. The person already knows the company. It sends a message to the rest of the team about what you're doing. But that shouldn't outweigh other key factors. And let's talk a little about the person if you promote within. One of the issues I see people fall into is the person they want to promote from within is the highest performing member of the sales team, the superstar. And they say, well, they're the superstar, therefore they should manage the team. They've contributed the most. But let's think back to the role of the sales team leader. You're a coach, an advocate, a developer of talent, one who enjoys achieving results to others. Most, not all, but most extremely high-performing salespeople tend to be very self-focused. Let's just get it on the table. They achieve great results, but they don't necessarily, as the saying goes, play well with others. They're folks that may ruffle a lot of feathers over in operations or in customer service because they're demanding they get their way right now. And they're not out interested in developing or mentoring other people. The person I would look for more than the absolute high performer, and it could be them, but not necessarily them, the person I look for is a person who works well with operations, works well with marketing, and has a track record of going out and mentoring and working with your new salespeople and being effective with them. Somebody who's shown an ability to work with others and enjoys developing talent. When you've got those skills and they have a successful track record in sales, because they need to have that successful track record to have other people's respect and be able to coach them. When they have those things and you get somebody internally, promote them. If those are missing, then you want to look outside.
I love the fact that you put your finger on these two elements. One is a proven track record in actually doing the selling, so that mm-hmm. the sales folks they'll be managing actually do have respect for them. And yet at the same time, they have to have this characteristic of being willing to start getting the results through others and not being the star who's closing the sales.
Exactly. And it helps if they have some at least good basic analytical capabilities so they can put together numbers and forecasts. And that's an added bonus I would certainly look for in that sales manager role that not necessarily there in all salespeople.
Yeah. When we talk about goals and we talk about numbers, so often I find clients struggling over what their compensation model should look like. Should it be all base, partial base, all commission, partial commission, and so on? And how what's the best way to go about figuring out what that ought to look like for a particular business?
It's going to be that depends answer. I'll give you my ultimate, if I could just create a single compensation plan for every situation, the one I would like best. But again, it doesn't fit all. The best to me is where you've got a reasonable base of maybe 30 to 40% of the total pay package. And the balance at 60 to 70% is in commissions and bonuses if they hit their target. That type of package tends to attract good talent. Most salespeople like a base of some level. So they've got some sense of the company's commitment to them. And highly motivated, aggressive salespeople like the ability to make a lot of money. So you give them a plan that gives them a real upside potential. With that said, key elements you got to look at in developing a comp plan for a particular company. One is, if you're looking, particularly looking to attract other talent from your industry, what are the norms for your industry? If you go to mortgage banking, the norm there is those are all commission packages. There is no base salary for salespeople. They may get what's called a draw, but it's simply a prepayment of commissions and the expectation they're going to close some deals and get something. Conversely, you go over to somebody that's selling maybe oil and that type of product and lubricants where it's a repeat sale, you're going in every month. those type of salespeople in those industries tend to have an 80% base, 20% commission. So a lot of it depends on the norms of your industry. Secondly, it also depends on the risk of your culture. Is it a risk-oriented culture? Is it a conservative culture? If you're a risk-oriented culture, some big software companies like Oracle tend to be very risk-oriented. They tend to have fairly low bases relative to the total comp package for those salespeople. Other companies in the software industry sometimes have 60 or 70% of base as part of the package because they tend to be very conservative companies, and that's who they want to hire, and that fits them. So it's a function of, you know, what you're selling, the industry norms, the risk of the culture, and also the length of sales cycle. So all those factors need to come into play when you're establishing what your compensation package is. One of the biggest issues I see with companies hiring sales teams for the first time is I want to hire somebody that's commission only because they won't cost me anything. And I really raise my hand to push back on that one. Because if the reason we're going to commission only plan is not because that's the industry norm and the way talent expects to be paid, but if we're doing it to say, I don't want to risk any money, and I want to hold my risk down and my expenses down in case this person doesn't work out, quote-unquote, then we put ourselves in a very poor hiring position. Because if we're not willing to take a risk on them, the talent we're likely to drag in isn't very good talent and won't turn out well. So if we're in an industry where base salaries are the norm, we need to be ready to pay a base salary and bring people in. The way you protect yourself is setting up clear expectations for the first 90 days. Number of sales calls, number of quotes brought in, quotes out, and potentially closed business, and track that very closely to see if the person's performing or not, but not to go with an all-commission-based plan simply because I don't want to pay a base and I want to avoid risk.
I'm so glad that you brought that up because I have a client who was indeed moving from solopreneur into expanding her team, and so first she brought in an operations person because what is it that she disliked dealing with the most? It was actually operations. So she brought in an operations person and literally pushed everything across the desk and said, here's the salary, here's everything that has to be taken care of. And then when it came to starting to expand by bringing in salespeople, I watched her really try to figure out how she could make it 100% commission, and it was so unrealistic because she had people who had families to feed and everything else and who were coming into this really fairly unusual company, and they were going to have to come up a learning curve and a relationship initiating and building curve and so on, and it took quite some doing to help that particular CEO understand, while she was and had been a solopreneur and knew she'd been able to close sales, that those sales had been based on long-term relationship building and so on, and that in order to get someone devoted to her and the company and the products, she really needed to demonstrate her commitment to them as well. So I'm so glad you brought that up.
Well, thank you. It's just one I see as well as you do about the desire to just go with all commission because it seems like the inexpensive way. And the other one I often hear as well, really good salespeople want all commission. And that's not so, because there are really good salespeople out there that come from an industry that pays base salaries, and part of their identity is around, I'm senior enough and achieved enough and I have a good enough sales track record that somebody's willing to pay me a $50,000 or $70,000 base salary. And if you come in and say, I'm not going to give you any base, and it's part of their identity and what they feel like they've earned, you're really taking away part of that identity or ego satisfaction for them. And it's real hard to get that person to come take on an opportunity like that, particularly when it's the first time you've ever had a salesperson out there.
Yeah, because indeed you haven't demonstrated you know how to manage a sales team, so that in turn also feels risky for them.
Exactly, and it leads to, you know, what else do salespeople look for besides money? When people say, well, salespeople are purely money motivated, and yes, there are some, that's pretty much their driver, but the vast majority of them, it's a more complex or deeper question or need than that. And in most studies, money's ranking like third or fourth. You know, a salesperson, and these are things they'll evaluate when they're considering joining your company, they're going to look for, how do you invest in me? How will you train me? I'm often involved in the hiring process for my clients and cross-screening folks, and a continual question I'll get very early in the interviews when I say, it's your turn to ask questions, is, tell me how you're going to train me on your company's product or service, because they want to hear you're making an investment so they can be successful. Because no matter how lucrative the compensation plan sounds, an experienced salesperson knows if they're not brought up to speed on how to sell, they're not going to be successful. Second key thing they're going to look for is, how are goals set? What word do I have in that? So they're part of a team developing this. And they're also looking for ego strokes or affirmation when they're doing a good job. You know, one of the cheapest ways to reward a sales team is public praise. As I said, it's a job with 90% rejection rates in it, so your ego can take a battering some days. When you've done something well, it means a lot to be recognized for it, whether it's bringing in a new order, maybe turning around a customer situation, and directly thank that salesperson, but share it with the sales team so they hear what's been done well and see a peer being recognized, and then share it with other people in the company so they know what the sales team's out doing for them. It really helps build loyalty in that sales team when they get recognized for what they've done well.
My husband has been a salesperson selling advertising for many, many years until he retired a few years ago. And the other really big one for him when he was evaluating a new opportunity was, tell me about the system you're going to ask me to use. I can use any system to really do well in sales.
Mm-hmm.
But if they come out with, well, it's up to you to create that system, that's the first thing he's going to walk out on. He wants a system that's proven itself already. Hopefully there's a little bit of flexibility so that when he goes out to use it, if it could be done in a more effective way, he's able to do that. But without that system, he's dead in the water. He can't sell anything.
I'm right with him that we need to give people the sales process, a sales system that's worked, and show them how it's been successful. And you're right, give them some freedom to operate with it so it's not a direct track they have to follow, but more there's a system, a process, and they understand the major steps, how we get attention, how we get interest in qualifying an account, and really close them on a deal.
And for the solopreneur who's, you know, they know their business so well, they don't necessarily have scripts for salespeople to use. They don't necessarily have the whole system in place. It can be challenging to put that system together for the sales team to then implement. What do you recommend for someone just getting started having sales teams? How do they get that system if it doesn't exist right now?
Well, to sit down and outline the steps they've taken on recent deals. If they are the one responsible for closing business, then sit down one evening and say, how did I first get started with them, and outline the steps they took, and think about how they pitch the company's product or services. And one of the things I offer clients is a program called 90 Day Quick Start, and it focuses on two things, because it's often the situation where we're putting together a sales team for the first time and we need to train them on the product or services. And we start with a sales job, and we want to bring somebody up to speed on it. We define all the things they need to know in that sales job. And I'm not talking about sales skills, because we're usually hiring experienced salespeople, but about the company, its markets, its product or services, the competition, and the internal parts of the company they need to know to be effective to sell it. So list out the knowledge they need to know. And then, because these are entrepreneur organizations, we don't have a training team there on staff to put this together or execute it. It's simple to start with an outline. If it's about how you sell to a board of directors, then outline, here's how you make that pitch, and who in the company can help train the person, and sit down and just do a chalk talk with them. So we list out the key components they've got to know, the knowledge, then begin to develop a schedule of when those things are going to occur, who's going to get transfer the knowledge to them. And at the end of every week, do a simple test. Have four or five questions you can ask them to understand how much they've learned or not learned, and bring them up to speed where they're short. Do that, you can really bring somebody up to speed in almost any situation within 30 days, where they can be off making effective sales calls. Yes, they have a lot more to learn, but now they've got a system to follow and know what to do when they're out in the field. Touching on one other thing here is when the entrepreneur is the sales manager, and it's often the situation when you first establish a sales team, counsel that entrepreneur to consider two things. Two things I hear that the entrepreneur often says to me is, you know, that person doesn't have the passion I have. And I'll look at them and say, You're the father or mother of this baby, your company. They're the aunt or the uncle. Yes, they're dedicated. Yes, they're family members. Yes, they're interested. But it's not their whole life like it is for you. So to expect them to have that same level of passion that you do is not there. And when they go off and make a sales call, they're never going to have the power of being the CEO out talking to another CEO. They're a salesperson. So they're in a different position to appreciate that as well. And also to appreciate, are they making effective sales calls? Are they bringing deals in? Not do they sell like me? Because it's a common complaint I hear is that salesperson doesn't sell like me. And I don't care whether it's Linda and I both making a sales call. She and I are going to sell differently. Gina will sell differently from either one of us. Everybody has their own sales style and sales approach. You want to look at it as, are they getting good results? Are they making effective calls? Not do they just sell like me?
Absolutely. And not only that, but sometimes the really good salespeople know when to walk away and not make a sale too. So in crafting the system, in educating them, it's up to you to educate them as to when it's not a good idea to really push for the sale anyway.
Gina, you've really hit on a big one there, and that is the need for a clear sales process that says it, at this stage in the sales cycle, I should know the following five things about this deal. It might be who are the competitors, what are the objections, where do we stand relative to our competition? And if we don't know those things, this sale's not progressing any further in here. It's very common I'll go in and hear something like, well, boss, I'll close this deal next month. It's 90% probability. 90% probability, yep, got to get it. Got this one locked, we'll get it next month. That's May. Come around to June, still not there, same story. Come around to July, yep, going to get it this month, 90% probability. August comes along, salesperson walks in and says, well, I lost that to our number one competitor. What? You told me it was a 90% chance of you're going to be able to win the deal. And you're saying, wait a second, how many competitors do we have? Well, it was ABC Company and another one. Oh, you mean we were one of three people still vying for the business and we had a 90% chance of winning? That didn't make sense to me. So getting salespeople to be clear about where the deal stands and helping them understand how to analyze a deal is a major help for them and a major tool. Because one of the big issues I see is salespeople, the good news, we're optimists. The bad news, we're optimists. So we always see that glass as half full, even if it's maybe not full at all, and helping them understand whether I've got a quarter full glass, a half full glass, or an almost full glass, and whether to invest time in that deal going forward or not.
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about with 100% commission positions, when it is a 100% commission position, the inclination in the salesperson is got to close every deal. They're going to work really hard on closing every deal. And it, in my organization especially, I don't want them closing every deal. Not everyone is my ideal customer. And while we could close deals, there are times where it's not really the person that I want in my organization as a customer. So if I'm only compensating based on what they're driving in sales and there's no other way for them to get compensated, then I'm going to have a lot of customers that I otherwise wouldn't necessarily have wanted because that's how they get compensated. So it's something to definitely take into consideration. Do you have any advice there?
Well, you're spot on with that, that if it's an all-commission plan, it's very hard to tell them not to chase deals because you said bring everything in.
Yeah.
The second part of that that goes along with it, whether it's an all-commission job or base plus commission, is get clear with the sales team about we want customers that look like this, we don't want customers that look like this.
Yeah.
And give them clear guidelines so when they bring it in and you say, you know, I said we really don't do well in the banking industry, we do much better in insurance or we do much better in manufacturing distribution, and let's say it's a software product, we don't have the extensions to fit there. And even if we make that sale, we're going to have an unhappy customer and tremendous support costs. So give them clarity about who to bring in and not. And then when they bring in somebody that doesn't fit, stop that early on before there's a big investment made.
Great advice. Great advice. Linda, we should let our listeners know how they can find Brad to get more of his wonderful advice.
Exactly. So in the show notes, you'll find a link to Brad at LeggettSales.com, LeggettSG, LeggettSales.com. And Brad, I know you'd be delighted to talk with people about that 90-day kickstart and any of the other work that you do with growing businesses.
Yes, I would, Linda. And it's been a pleasure to be on your show today. So I would welcome if somebody wants to call in with a specific question, I'd be glad to answer it for them. And I want to thank you and Gina for having me on today.
Thank you, and thank you so much
for coming
and sharing the real practicalities of building and expanding sales efforts in a business, whether it's a solopreneur or if someone's leading a growing multi-million-dollar company. The issues remain the core issues.
They do, and thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Brad.
All right.
Linda and I will be back next week, same time, same place. Have a great week, everybody.
Join us Tuesday at noon Eastern for the next episode of Breakthrough Directions, from relationship marketing to business success.